contributing to a sluggish colon and constipation. The part of the lymphatic system that surrounds the gut can also get overburdened, causing lymphatic fluid buildup that creates pressure against the intestines that's enough to slow down peristaltic action and create narrower areas that make it more difficult for food to pass through. This alone can create mild bloating, causing the belly to become hard and pushed out. Pathogens, along with their toxic debris and sludge, as well as heavy metals, can find their way into the ileum along with food that hasn't been digested and broken down properly, causing this final section of the small intestine to become inflamed and contribute to constipation. In truth, it's the most common area of the intestine to be inflamed. Scar tissue can also form here. For a man, constipation can lead to what feels like a prostate condition, with frequent urination and pressure on the bladder, or he can experience no additional symptoms besides bloating and constipation. For a woman, it can be much more challenging. For one, constipation can get more intense and uncomfortable around ovulation and menstruation. Women with PCOS, cysts or fibroids can also experience great difficulty from constipation that results when an inflamed or cystic uterus or ovary presses up against the intestinal tract, narrowing the passageway. It can also be an inflamed colon pressing up against the uterus and ovaries, causing discomfort, pain, cramping, and constipation. An inflamed colon can press up against the bladder too, causing the feeling of urgency for women, due to the construction of nerves that makes women's bladders more sensitive than men's. When someone has endometriosis, whether diagnosed or undiagnosed, the intestinal, stomach, and bladder symptoms can be even more uncomfortable. If someone has had her or his appendix out, a scar or adhesion can form on the bottom right of the colon, making it more difficult for food to get through the ileocecal valve and causing a particular variety of constipation. And when the colon is inflamed for any reason, it can kink slightly around its different bends. The top of the descending colon on the left side of the abdomen is a very common spot for a kink. So is the bottom of the descending colon on that left side. A kink can also occur at the top of the ascending colon when there's inflammation. While these spots can contribute to constipation, pain, and discomfort, they're not true obstructions or blockages. The truth about irritable bowel syndrome. When someone is eating a lot of troublemaking foods, such as dense proteins, dairy, eggs, gluten, and for people who are more sensitive, any type of grains, the problems you've just read about can intensify and lead to irritable bowel syndrome, known as IBS. In medical research and science, it's a label for bowels that aren't functioning as they should, with cause unknown. Celiac is another instance of mystery intestinal inflammation, with some functional medicine sources calling it autoimmune, that is, the body attacking itself. That is not an accurate explanation. In truth, celiac is inflammation caused by the same sources as much of what we've discussed in this chapter. Pathogens. Gluten in particular is a problem for those with celiac because it feeds bacteria and viruses so they can prosper and cause more symptoms. IBS results when the colon is lined with pathogenic waste product, elevated levels of strep, E. coli, other pathogenic varieties, rotting food that wasn't digested properly due to low bile and hydrochloric acid, and ammonia gas. Contributing to it all are unproductive foods that feed the condition, for example, dense, fats and proteins that bile and hydrochloric acid can't break down anymore, entering the intestines and feeding pathogens rapidly. Then reaching the colon, the final dumping ground for the mess. Inflammation that prompts pain, constipation, and or diarrhea results, and even hemorrhoids, polyps, and fissures can form from the strain, as well as an itchy rectum from the irritation. Gut healing. Not only are the symptoms and conditions in this chapter uncomfortable, the gut also can't absorb, alter, and deliver nutrients at its full capacity when it's in distress. That means the liver doesn't get all the sustenance it needs, which contributes to someone's overall suffering. At the same time, if someone has any kind of gut disorder, it takes longer to heal when the liver has lost its own ability to absorb, alter, and deliver nutrients throughout the body. The gut and liver, meant to rely on each other, end up each paying the price for the other's vulnerability. Figuring out how to heal is no vicious cycle or chicken and egg conundrum. The answer is clear. Helping the gut starts with helping the liver. The liver is essential to healing any kind of intestinal issue, and lending it a helping hand with the tools you'll find in this book will finally give you digestive relief. Chapter 26. Brain fog. When you hear that someone has brain fog, it doesn't sound all that serious if you haven't experienced it yourself. It's easy to say, snap out of it, or, you're tired, get some coffee and get through it. Those who have brain fog know it's not as simple or easy to beat as it sounds. True brain fog, not just grogginess from a late night out, that has you reaching for an extra serving of caffeine to get you through the next day, can be very disruptive in someone's life. It can be detrimental to the point of diminishing people's vitality and keeping them from accomplishing what they want to accomplish. I've seen brain fog stop students from getting their degrees, not just in higher learning. I've seen it cause high school students to drop out. I've seen brain fog stop mums from being able to take their babies for walks in the park. I've seen people lose their jobs and careers over brain fog, resigning or being handed a pink slip and let go. So when we talk about brain fog, it's serious. It has affected a lot of people's lives. The guts of the matter. When brain fog isn't being blamed on the thyroid, it's often thrown in the category of gut health these days, with articles and professionals saying that it's all about candida, yeast, mold, and other fungus in the intestinal tract. A fuzzy mind, confusion, and lack of focus that take away a person's vitality and ability to function like she or he used to, it's considered digestive. The truth is that people can have the dirtiest, nastiest small intestines and colons filled with bacteria, yeast, loads of candida, mold, and other fungus, and yet not experience brain fog. That's right. These people could be using the public restroom with mucus from bacterial byproduct discharging from their bowels, leaving behind two kinds of strep on the toilet for the next person to come and get, and still experience no brain fog. If they did have any brain fog, it would be aversion so mild they wouldn't even think to call it that. Then you could have someone who does have a track record of yeast, mold, and other fungus in the intestinal tract, and who does experience brain fog. Or you could have someone whose intestinal tract is clean as a whistle, with no serious gut problems, and still has a problem with brain fog. This is all because brain fog is not a product of the gut. It's just a trendy misbelief and a mistaken hypothesis that brain fog is gut-related, and it's sent thousands of people on a wild goose chase for answers. We still want to keep our guts clean. It's not as if bacterial and fungal overgrowth in the intestines helps our health. A proliferation of strep in the intestinal tract does contribute to constipation, gastritis, other inflammation, intestinal scar tissue, diverticulitis, diverticulosis, colitis, IBS, diarrhea, intestinal narrowing and expanding, upper intestinal distension, a sense of burning in the stomach, sharp pains and stitches in the abdomen, cramping and bloating. What about the people with these digestive discomforts who don't have brain fog, though? We can't package this topic up in a tidy bow, leave the liver out of it, say, oh yeah, brain fog is all about gut problems, and call it a day. The few who say, I don't leave the liver out of it, I consider the liver part of the gut, still don't know the real reason for brain fog, which is why it's time you knew. Real reasons for brain fog. Brain fog mostly stems from the liver and partly from the brain. As you know by now, the liver harbours certain troublemakers, for example, the pathogen EBV. Many, many people carry an EBV viral load in the liver without realising it. If your liver is also filled with other troublemakers, they'll provide food to the virus. One such food is adrenaline, which you know the liver soaks up like a sponge in order to protect you from this stress hormone scorching your central nervous system when you're in fight or flight, even the milder forms of it, like driving in heavy traffic. That fear-based adrenaline is one food source for EBV. Toxic heavy metals and pesticides are other favourite viral foods. The very reason that viruses such as EBV camp out in the liver is because the food sources there are so plentiful. When EBV consumes them, it releases different forms of waste matter, one of which is a neurotoxin. As the liver fills up with these neurotoxins, it reaches capacity, at which point they escape into the bloodstream as blood is flowing from the liver. Neurotoxins have a unique travel ability, an infiltration quality, almost like a fumigant, that allows them to easily transport themselves to different places. It's what lets them cross the blood-brain barrier. In the brain, they can cloud up, interfere with, and short-circuit neurotransmitters. Neurotoxins in the blood and cerebrospinal fluid are a big factor in brain fog. Medical communities are unaware that neurotransmitter chemicals are supposed to be clean and pure in order to work. Neurotoxins make them dirty. Harbouring homeopathic, minute levels of mercury and other metals and toxins, neurotoxins are polluted. When they enter into neurotransmitter chemicals, they pollute them too. As an electrical impulse runs down a neuron using an impure neurotransmitter chemical, it doesn't burn clean. The impulse is shorted out, diminished, or left to run on less power. That makes neurotransmitter chemicals dirtied by neurotoxins, a recipe for brain fog. This will take at least 50 years to uncover. EBV neurotoxins are not the only cause of brain fog, though. Someone could have adrenal issues from prolonged periods of excess stress, and that adrenal dysfunction could have resulted in erratic spurts of adrenaline that the liver then sponged up, causing it to become more stagnant, which in turn could have lowered energy, allowing for a mild brain fog. Adrenaline can also get into the brain, where it can be highly corrosive to neurotransmitter activity by quickly diminishing neurotransmitter chemicals and electrolytes as it courses through. Over time, our ability to create new neurotransmitter chemicals can also diminish due to poor diet and the condition of the liver. The list goes on. You can also develop brain fog from toxic heavy metals such as mercury and aluminium in the brain that oxidize and create a metallic runoff that can saturate brain tissue, short-circuiting electrical impulses and hindering neurotransmitters. This type of brain fog is a little different from others. It comes and goes, with moments of clarity and then confusion, though it's not the everyday, mild type of confusion that we might call a brain cramp. Brain fog can also develop when the liver has become toxic with other types of troublemakers, such as solvents, prescription drugs, and toxic chemicals. People with this form of non-viral brain fog experience less fatigue and tire less easily than when a virus is in play. A viral liver, EBV neurotoxins, adrenaline surges, toxic heavy metals, and other liver troublemakers. These are the various reasons for brain fog. Everyone's brain fog is different and deserves to have its real causes recognized and identified individually. What brain fog is not about for anyone is the gut. Clearing up the confusion. When someone with brain fog visits a practitioner, that healthcare provider should not fall prey to the belief that it's gut-related. It's an easy mistake to make. Say a practitioner does tell a patient that her or his brain fog is really a gut problem. What's the next step? Clean up the diet. As a result, that patient could see improvements. So it's going to seem to everyone that the gut hypothesis was correct. This is where the confusion lies. What really happens is that when we clean up the diet, removing junk food and fast food and processed foods, we're unknowingly boosting the liver, allowing it to detox more efficiently and offering the adrenals a little more support than usual. Though it likely cleaned up the gut too, that wasn't what cleared up the brain fog. Case in point. There are people with very high viral loads and sluggish livers congested with neurotoxins who improve their diets according to what healthcare professionals believe is good for gut health and still suffer with brain fog. That's because these diets aren't specifically aimed at getting the viral issues out, strengthening the liver, extracting neurotoxins, fortifying the adrenals, and rebuilding neurotransmitter chemicals. It ends up being hit or miss whether various popular diets do any of this, which means these diets are hit or miss for alleviating brain fog. What really helps brain fog is knowing what's really causing it, so you can directly address viral issues, liver saturation, toxic heavy metals, and other troublemakers and adrenal overload. Lifting the fog. Brain fog is a big part of our world. It affects a lot of lives, both of the people who experience it directly and the ones around them. It's time they all knew what's responsible for brain fog. So many mistakes are made in this area. So many people are blamed for their brain fog and called lazy, irresponsible, uninspired, or unpassionate. People are called silly and even stupid because of brain fog. Children are misunderstood and misdiagnosed because of brain fog. When young adults can't find the right words to express themselves, and the words that come out of their mouths don't come out the way they want, that can be brain fog. Adults often feel inadequate or useless. That can be brain fog. When anyone has difficulty making decisions and feels like the process sucks the life out of them, that can be brain fog. It was never supposed to come to this. Understanding brain fog for what it really is, we can identify the issues people are struggling with and stop misunderstanding and mislabeling them. We can stop misunderstanding and mislabeling ourselves. You're not guilty of bringing brain fog upon yourself. There are reasons you've experienced it, and with the tools in Part 4, you can free yourself from it. It's time we lifted this fog so we can all see the truth. Chapter 27. Emotional Liver, Mood Struggles, and Sad. When we call people emotional, we usually mean that we think they're being too sensitive or even acting ridiculous. In those moments, we decide whether we're going to hear these people out and listen to their emotional concerns because we care or need to work with them, or we're going to keep our distance and not poke into their emotions. Either way, there's usually an element of judgment that we attach to that word emotional. If you're the one experiencing an emotional issue, you may doubt to yourself. While you may be able to point to a trigger for a mood swing, like a package that didn't come on time or a significant other acting out of sorts, you may also know that's not the real problem and say to yourself, "I've never been that sensitive before." You may decide it's hormonal, given the hormonal blame that's been thrown upon women for decades. If you stay in a funk too long, a friend or a loved one may tell you that you need to seek help and talk out what's really making you emotional. What no one ever considers in all of this is that the real instigator could be the liver. The story of seasonal affective disorder. A good example of liver-related emotional struggle is the condition seasonal affective disorder, SAD. The symptoms of SAD range from feeling kind of sad, gloomy, devalued, lonely or lost, to feeling hopeless, severely depressed, discarded or even devastated for no apparent reason. It can reach the point of mental torture and suicidal feelings. A range of physical symptoms can develop too, from low energy that makes you a little tired and sluggish, to a feeling of fatigue that makes your arms and legs heavy to the point that you can't even walk easily. Almost an arthritic feeling, as well as aches and pains, focus and concentration issues, and possibly a little weight gain. When the cause of someone's suffering isn't obvious, the way it is when an MRI reveals an aneurysm or a tumour, the medical industry struggles to figure out what's wrong with patients. In the absence of answers, it's human nature for medical communities to look for outside possibilities and excuses. SAD falls into that category. Enough people went to their doctors complaining of the onset or worsening of the symptoms above that the SAD label developed relatively recently as an easy explanation that blamed the change of weather that comes with autumn and winter. That's how it started out. When researchers present a hypothesis, it doesn't always mean that the medical establishment is going to recognize it. SAD had no guarantee of making it to the mainstream. The medical industry recognized and adopted the SAD label because it was a reason to stop looking deeper for answers behind chronic illness and save funding for other causes. Though recent history, it was an early enough time that it wasn't all about genes yet. This was just before the raging everything is genes theory started to dominate, and chronic illness was even less respected than it is today, with it's all in your head even more common. With SAD, medical communities acknowledged people's symptoms, yet the tag became a decoy that negated what people were really experiencing. The way it's conceived of now is that as winter comes, our melatonin and serotonin levels drop, bringing on SAD symptoms. Many also believe that it's a lack of vitamin D in winter. How to explain then all the people it affects at other times of the year, and all the people taking high doses of vitamin D and still experiencing SAD? Over time, doctors realized that these symptoms weren't just affecting people in the colder, darker months. They were also coming on in spring and summer. And so the definition of sad was expanded to avoid funding the search for deeper issues. Any time of year now, the sad label can apply. Pick a month, pick any part of any season, which should tell you that there's something amiss with the way research and science conceive of this condition. The truth is that there are hundreds upon hundreds of different variations of it. If medical communities started categorizing them, they'd realize something else is going on. What is sad, really? Many people experience 10 years of sad symptoms, whether in winter, summer, or any other time of year, and each year it slowly worsens. Someone can progress from that arthritic feeling I mentioned to severe aches and joint pain, leading to another confusing diagnosis, rheumatoid arthritis. For that person, it was never sad to begin with. It was a very, very mild form of RA, which, if you read Medical Medium or Thyroid Healing, you know is an EBV-related illness. Were the seasons playing a role in agitating the RA? It's possible. Winter is hard on the body. Most any condition you have will tend to feel worse in this season. Another example of a condition misdiagnosed as sad is sinus cavity sensitivity. When the weather turns cool, the dry, hot air inside of buildings can aggravate the sinuses and cause them to ache only in late fall and winter. What someone could really be experiencing is chronic dehydration that causes the sinus membranes to be dry and sensitive, or an old deposit of strep in the sinuses from a sinus infection injury decades ago, one that could have scarred the sinuses. Low-grade strep infections are common in the sinuses, and they create sinus sensitivities such as seasonal allergies, headaches, and nosebleeds that are not diagnosed properly as strep. These bacteria are very elusive and can hide inside the sinus cavities for a lifetime. The SAD label is one of the saddest misdiagnoses out there. It takes advantage of the fact that we all do feel a boost on beautiful sunny days with moderate temperatures and low humidity, and it ignores everything else wrong with people. That deprives them of the opportunity to get better. Yes, a seasonal change can affect our health. When winter comes in a cold climate, we don't take as many walks in nature, we don't eat the freshest food, we don't get in our farmers' market trips and feast on a pint of strawberries here or there. That is, we don't do what we normally would to support the immune system. So if we're not upping our game in other ways as the weather gets colder, any problem under the surface will peek out its ugly head a little more. Almost all people with SAD end up getting worse, with new labels and diagnoses along the way over the course of a lifetime, because the underlying problems aren't being addressed. It's not just RA or sinus issues that get ignored. Someone who's had low energy for the last 5 winters may develop deeper fatigue in the 6th year and finally receive a diagnosis of Lyme disease. While it may be a misdiagnosis, nevertheless, it's a diagnosis brought on by the fact that symptoms are worsening. SAD is a way of not taking seriously the early symptoms of what could turn into an aggressive and progressive health condition. Let's talk more about the symptoms attributed to SAD. When you're dealing with depression, anxiousness, anxiety, sadness, nervousness, fatigue, whether mild or severe, or aches and pains, know that these are often neurological. In truth, almost every symptom associated with SAD, except for weight gain, can be neurological, whether it's feeling suicidal or feeling sad and lost or experiencing physical discomfort, the brain or another part of the nervous system is being affected by some deeper cause to create these symptoms, and it's not a change in season. While the season could be a trigger, it's not the cause. Aches and pains in the feet occur when the tibial and sciatic nerves are inflamed. Headaches, migraines, and tingles and numbness that cold air or heat and humidity can trigger to worsen are caused by the trigeminal, phrenic, and vagus nerves. Focus and concentration issues are related to weakened neurotransmitters. Anxiety and depression can come on when the liver gets viral and starts releasing neurotoxins, or when the liver gets overloaded with prescription drugs such as antibiotics and starts releasing oxidized heavy metals which go to the brain and short-circuit neurotransmitter activity. The emotions that go with sad, whether they have you feeling angry, frustrated, abandoned, crushed, forgotten, or the like, have to do with your brain being affected by the true story of what's occurring inside your liver. The liver's unhappiness is the foundation of our emotional instability. All of those neurological symptoms that are blamed on the seasons actually originate with the liver. For one, when the bloodstream is filled with neurotoxins, which are created when pathogens feed on toxic heavy metals, such as mercury in the liver, focus and concentration can go awry as these toxins soak into the brain and wreak havoc, causing electrical impulses there to short-circuit. For another, emotions such as frustration and anger can arise from a sluggish, pre-fatty or fatty liver. A liver that's burdened with fat, struggling, losing its strength and fighting for its life. That's right. The liver has emotions, and we can feel them. The liver experiencing a downtime is almost enough to give us a bodily sensation of sadness, concern, disconnect, or crankiness on its own. Then add in the poisons that enter our brain at any given moment, as well as what life throws at us every day, and you can have an instant condition that a doctor may diagnose as sad or give another label. Our emotional livers. Now, you could say, how is it possible that the liver has emotions? The answer is that with the sophistication of being able to perform over 2,000 chemical functions comes the ability to think for itself. The liver decides when to access the power of these chemical functions. It can make its own decisions. It also stores the information of our lives. Given that level of ability and responsibility, how could it not have emotions? We're not robots. Our livers aren't made out of metal, wire, and plastic. They're flesh and blood with intelligence. When someone receives a liver transplant, she takes on the patterns that the donor exhibited. The liver recipient becomes emotional in ways she never did before. She experiences new desires, new thoughts, new beliefs, new habits, new expressions, new food cravings, new hobbies, new dreams at night. She could have the same dreams the donor had when she was alive, and new dreams in the sense of goals and aspirations. That's the power the liver holds, because it's a living, emotional, thinking, breathing, functioning part of our bodies. In fact, whether it was a liver you received via transplant or one you were born with, your liver has to make more decisions than you do in any given day. With so much to do, again, how can it not get emotional? The liver plays a huge role in our emotional state of being. A prime example is when the liver goes into spasm. It's similar to when a person throws a tantrum. Liver spasms are the organ's attempts to free itself and ignite new energy when it feels confined or held back. Sometimes the spasm will even set off your own emotional reaction, causing you to feel caged or trapped, to feel the need to get out and go for a run, or to have the sensation of wanting to crawl out of your own skin. When the liver gets toxic, and it's holding on to a tremendous amount of poisons, such as radiation, pesticides, herbicides, nanotechnology materials, toxic heavy metals, bacteria, viruses, and pathogenic waste matter, like dermatoxins, some of the poisons can leach into the bloodstream and intestinal tract, as you've heard before. They can cause some of the issues we've examined, like eczema, psoriasis, and dry, cracking skin, that are also mistakenly blamed on SAD because they get worse in winter. These poisons can travel through the bloodstream to the brain, causing problems there, such as an up one minute, down the next feeling that can result in a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Adrenaline has come up in previous chapters, and this is another instance where its interplay with the liver is important. Breakups, betrayals, being stabbed in the back, your liver wants to prevent you from becoming intoxicated by adrenaline when this steroid races through your bloodstream during these and other traumatic moments. Your liver becomes so nervous and even scared for your life that it releases a hormone undiscovered by science that draws excess adrenaline into the liver so the organ can sop it up to protect you from stroking out, from neurotransmitters in the brain burning out, and from hemorrhage. When the liver soaks up excess adrenaline from the bloodstream during bouts of intense stress and other adrenal triggers, though, it's only a temporary solution. Over time, it must release the adrenaline stores bit by bit to be eliminated through the kidneys and intestinal tract so it can be prepared to receive a new batch the next time you have an adrenal surge. As the adrenaline leaves, you'll experience the information stored within it in a nostalgic or almost surreal way. Even if the adrenaline was from a month ago, 6 months ago, or a year ago or more, you'll feel a little loss, frustration, or anger to accompany it. The liver tends to release its storage bins of adrenaline with the change of seasons. It will send out a little spurt to prepare for fall, and a little extra spurt as a detox to prepare for winter. The liver will often let go of a heavy amount of adrenaline for spring, and that release can last throughout late spring and early summer, so you may find yourself processing emotions from up to 9 years ago, making you feel lost, as adrenaline holding on to that information slowly circulates out of your body. When your liver took on this adrenaline originally released during your emotional trials and tribulations, it also took on and held on to your emotional experiences. Its release can trigger the same painful feelings you had when the adrenaline was first released at a time of struggle, because it holds this emotional essence. As the liver lets go, you let go too. Touching back on liver transplants, a transplanted liver is usually filled with adrenaline. When a new person receives that liver, she'll experience the sadness, loss, emptiness, or other emotions stored inside when the liver is ready to release the hormone. As adrenaline flows out of the liver, the donor's experiences of emotional hardship will ring through the recipient's body, and the recipient could experience the feelings associated with the ups and downs of the donor's life. If the liver was hungry for a certain food that it never got from the donor, when it's transplanted, it will keep asking for that food, which may even change the appetite and palate of the person who received the liver. More on cravings in a moment. I'm not trying to undermine SAD itself. The symptoms are very, very real. When you're tricked and fooled with a cover-up label, though, you get cheated from stopping the condition whichever condition it may be for you, from getting worse. Another sad part about SAD is the amount of antidepressants people are offered when they suffer with these symptoms. Antidepressants that saturate the liver more, giving it a heavier burden that makes SAD symptoms worse. For many people, these medications can take a case of SAD that once came only during the liver's annual winter release of adrenaline and extend it all year. That's not to take lightly the importance of antidepressants for some situations. Medication is indeed critical in those severe cases where someone is feeling suicidal, until natural solutions carefully brought in alleviate the situation. We need to know where this is all stemming from if we want to give someone long-term relief. We can't stamp the SAD label on real symptoms and conditions that are developing in people for real reasons and act like that's a solution. Experiences of SAD are experiences of liver issues. An unexpected factor. Here's the most common reason that SAD sufferers experience symptoms in the late fall and early winter. Dietary changes. The light and temperature changes alone have us going into hibernation mode and eating differently from normal. Then Halloween comes, and with it, candy everywhere. Soon after, we get the time change that puts us off kilter and drinking a little more coffee to stay alert later. This loads the liver up with caffeine, one more item it must store to protect you. Less than a month later, it's Thanksgiving, and instead of the strawberries, walks, and salads of summertime, we're eating heavier foods. Already on Black Friday, the rush of the holiday season begins, with cookies set out at the office, parties that encourage a few too many glasses of wine, champagne, or eggnog, and other treats around every corner. While it may seem like only an indulgence here and an indulgence there, it adds up. People don't realize how much extra work they give their livers to do at this time of year. As you've heard throughout this audiobook, they also don't realize how burdened their livers become from years of toxin exposure and not eating well. The holidays can push the liver over the edge. The influx of liver troublemakers can force the organ to take on the extra fat of fall and wintertime treats. That extra fat is why people tend to gain weight at the holidays, or to overspill and release. This second factor, release, is one reason why you'll feel extra emotional as you get toward the end of the calendar year. Just as adrenaline that's released on the liver's schedule is attached to emotions, the adrenaline that's attached to toxins that the liver is forced to let go of can bring out emotions. It could be that at a funeral 8 years ago you ate a ham sandwich to wash down your sorrows. All this time your brain has stored away the memory within its database, even if you can't consciously remember it, and your liver has stored that emotional information along with the cheap hams, ammonia, nitrates, other preservatives, and fat that it neutralized and took on to protect you. Now overburdened from all the present-day holiday treats, the liver needs to release some of what it took on from that sandwich long ago, giving you a mild feeling of sorrow again, as the old troublemakers that you consumed in a time of grief travel through your bloodstream. That's just one of hundreds of examples. As organized as the liver tries to stay, with different compartments for different types of stored toxins, it does keep a miscellaneous storage bin. Back in Chapter 5, Your Protective Liver, I mentioned that the liver can end up like a trash dump. Have you ever seen the junk area at a dump? There will be toilets and sinks in one pile, bikes and scooters in another, cans and bottles lumped together, and then, inevitably, the miscellaneous pile where people have tossed beds, mattresses, cardboard boxes, windows, roof shingles, motorcycles, baby carriages, car tyres and more. All of it meant to be sorted eventually. If there's just one person tending the dump, though, and more refuse keeps rolling in, that miscellaneous pile will keep getting bigger until it overflows. That's how it works for your liver and its miscellaneous storage area, which it uses for those moments when it's truly bombarded by toxins and fats, trying to take in and process them as fast as it can. It will throw in items like the troublemakers from a funeral reception ham sandwich, hairspray from a prom that went bad, air freshener from a waiting room where you were awaiting bad news, chemically treated fire pit wood, and excess alcohol from a cookout where your relationship broke up, and even little bits of adrenaline. The liver is not being sloppy in throwing them all together. It's being as efficient as it can in the moment, with the goal of using chemical functions to sort out the miscellaneous pile and categorize its contents properly later. The liver can only get to that organizing stage when we treat it well. Most people aren't on track to give the liver the break it needs to do this. We leave it to be the lone worker at the dump instead of teaming up with it because we don't know otherwise. And since organizing the miscellaneous pile is last on the liver's to-do list, it often doesn't get to it. When it comes time to purge, to make room for more, it's this pile that gets emptied. Out come the ham sandwiches, troublemaking ingredients, and any of the other miscellaneous junk the liver sees fit to toss out, and with them, out come cravings. Along with the sorrow, which you probably won't be aware traces back to the funeral, you'll likely get a hankering for ham. Anytime you detox, whether in a healthy way endorsed by the liver, or when it's forced to empty some of its miscellaneous storage bin to make room for more in the moment, emotions can come up as the toxins leave. It happens both during the liver's stress bomb time, that is the never-ending indulgence buffet of fall and winter, and also, as we saw, in those seasonal shifts when the liver releases previously stored excess adrenaline. Cravings are a subject you'll recall if you read Life-Changing Foods. A craving for a honey-baked ham, a double bacon cheeseburger, or other burdensome food for that matter, is not your body telling you that you need iron or protein. The best way to handle these cravings is not to give in to them, and instead to opt for nourishing comfort foods like the recipes you'll find throughout the Medical Medium series. Always forgiven. Your liver also possesses the memory bank we examined earlier in this book, a catalogue of what you've experienced as well as the ebb and flow of your lifestyle. This means that on top of everything else we've looked at in this chapter to explain why symptoms often come with the seasonal shifts, your liver also anticipates when it's your pattern to get sad at the holidays. It knows whether the end of the year was tough for you growing up because of certain family experiences, and so when that time starts to roll around again, your liver can start to become emotional too, which you'll pick up on without knowing it. This means that the holiday season, rather than a time to trash our livers, is actually the time when we should be taking care of them the most. Luckily, the liver is very forgiving. It has great patience. At the same time, it has a challenge, your mind. If it doesn't have forgiveness and patience built into it yet, your liver, extremely intelligent and emotional, has the smarts and reason to know that your mind may not be looking out for it. When the mind behaves irrationally, without logic, it makes decisions that burden the liver, whether poor food choice, drug use, or adrenaline rush activities. In these cases, the liver must become even more forgiving, sensitive, and heartful. Because yes, Your liver has heart, since the liver's number one job is to protect the heart. In order to protect your ticker, the liver must relate to it, just as a mother or other primary caregiver for a baby must be attuned to the baby's every need. When the mind is reckless, immature, unreasonable, irrational, or egomaniacal, the liver balances it out with supreme fortitude. The emotional liver lives inside of us, in you and in me. It has heart. It has smarts. It has feelings. Know this for certain. We can live with it, and we can't live without it. Chapter 28. Pandas, jaundice, and baby liver. We come into this world with compromised livers. While we think of infants as beginning life with a clean slate, the truth is that a developing baby's liver takes on the past. In utero, and even at the moment we were conceived, we inherited liver troublemakers from our parents, their parents before them, and so on down the family line. Any poison or pathogen that an ancestor has carried can end up in our livers before we're born. Plus, early standard medical treatments for babies can fill newborns' livers with troublemakers. So instead of being born with our livers functioning at 100% like they were in indigenous cultures centuries ago, or even 90 or 95% as they were in more recent history, the average healthy person today is born with a liver running at 70% at best. Since we don't learn how to care for our livers, that percentage gradually drops over the course of someone's lifetime, for some more quickly than others, depending on exposures. It can already start to slowly reduce early in life, and early liver trouble translates to many of the mystery health conditions that arise in babies and children. Signs and symptoms of baby liver. One is gastric distress. It's not uncommon for newborns to display an inability to take in liquids, whether breast milk or formula, without chronic acid reflux. When a baby's intestinal tract is freshly developed and that baby starts to receive its food supply orally after birth, it's a shock to the system. Though taking on nutrients like this to survive and thrive is a natural progression of life, it comes as a digestive disruption early on that can cause the baby to regurgitate the liquid, that is, spit up. Sometimes a baby spits up so frequently that it becomes alarming and sends the mum to the doctor's office with baby in tow. The doctor will often diagnose the problem as acid reflux and, in many cases, offer an acid reflux medication. What's really causing the problem, though? Most every pediatrician dreads this visit, because to medical research and science, infant acid reflux is a complete mystery, and there's not a lot to offer besides a good bedside manner and antacids. They have theories. Theories that the baby's intestinal tract or stomach hasn't developed properly, it isn't kinked right, or is still developing. Theories that the baby's intestinal tract is so soft and pliable that sitting at certain angles puts pressure on the duodenum, at the top of the small intestine, creating a very slight impediment that causes reflux. In almost all cases, the pediatrician will say that your baby will grow out of it, and most of the time it does pass. Within a week, a month, or a year, the GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease-like symptoms, will seem to dissipate. What never goes away is the conundrum of why it happened in the first place. In some cases, if the baby was nursing when the problem developed, the mum's breast milk gets the blame. This disheartening theory could cause her to switch over to one formula, then to another, only to find that the acid reflux still won't go away, and there was never anything wrong with her breast milk. After that guessing game, confusion and fear, she likely has to build back her confidence in her ability to mother. What's really behind a baby's acid reflux are the liver and gallbladder. It's a sign and symptom of what I call baby liver, when the liver struggles from the beginning of life because of all it's inherited. In particular, a baby's acid reflux is a baby's liver that's struggling to produce its first rounds of bile. Baby livers do not naturally produce a lot of bile at the beginning. They only need small amounts because breast milk is more sugar than fat. The small amount of fat that is in human breast milk is the only fat in existence that needs very, very little bile. So it's easy to break down, digest, and disperse. It is also structured in such a way that it can coexist with the breast milk's sugar and not cause insulin resistance or clash the way fats combined with sugars normally do in our diets. This is similar to how the sugar and fat in avocados coexist, and it's one of the reasons that avocado is the closest food to breast milk. Babies' stomachs only produce small amounts of hydrochloric acid at the beginning too, because breast milk is very low in protein, and the protein it does contain is more assimilable than any other protein on the planet. Since breast milk is basically nourishing sugar water, and that sugar has a pre-digested factor, a baby doesn't need to use much digestion to break it down, so not much hydrochloric acid is needed. That said, what little bile and hydrochloric acid a baby does need to produce is still important. When a baby's liver is weak from the start, it can create a digestive issue. Because baby liver translates to bile underproduction and low hydrochloric acid. When a baby's liver is sluggish or stagnant right from the start, born with poisons and toxins and hampered by the effects of standard medical treatments from birth and continuing through early life, bile and hydrochloric acid will diminish even more. What little fat and protein there are in breast milk, the baby will have a harder time digesting on a micro scale, resulting in those GERD-like symptoms that are a mystery to doctors. What really causes jaundice? Now, if a baby also has jaundice, another symptom of baby liver, with yellow in the skin, eyes or tongue, doctors will instantly know they're dealing with a liver problem. Still, they won't connect the dots that the acid reflux is also liver-related, because it's not in their training. The theory with jaundice in newborns, that's right, it's only a theory, is that a baby's liver is so brand new that it hasn't developed enough to fully handle the normal liver responsibility of processing, dispersing, and detoxing red blood cells. That's not what jaundice is about. Jaundice is actually a baby's liver trying to overcome a highly toxic load to rev its engine and function in the face of obstacles that are not understood by medical research and science, because early medical treatments the baby first receives are some of the obstacles. The others are inherited troublemakers from the family line. Meanwhile, jaundice is a baby's liver that's in shock, trying to start up its over 2,000 chemical functions and short-circuiting in the process. Imagine a farmer goes out to a field and tries to start up an old tractor she hasn't used in years. As she turns the ignition, the engine pops and fizzes, maybe blows some smoke, and certainly misses a beat as it tries to cough out build-up. That's exactly what's happening with baby liver. Troublemakers inherited and exposed to at the beginning of life are like old engine oil in a baby's liver. Yes, it's possible for a newborn's liver to be dirty. since it inherits toxins at conception and in the womb. It could have been the parents' diet 20 years ago, poisons that have been passed from generation to generation, or any number of other factors that led a baby's liver to take on troublemakers. The medical establishment doesn't have a reason to look past its theory that jaundice is a newborn's liver that hasn't caught up to speed yet, since jaundice eventually dissipates. Red blood cells detox and the overabundance of bilirubin reduces. What's really happening is that most babies' livers, after the initial struggle starting up, are able to overcome the obstacles and find an acceptable balance pretty quickly. Jaundice disappearing doesn't mean complications of baby liver have gone away. It doesn't mean a baby's liver is functioning perfectly and that there aren't other signs of liver trouble that no doctor is going to connect to the liver. Baby belly, that bloating and distension in little ones, is a sign of baby liver. Stomach aches and intestinal issues that ultimately get diagnosed as parasites, candida, celiac. Really, the liver's a big part of why they're happening. A hornet's nest of answers. Most of the time, a baby's gastric condition occurs without jaundice. Another liver condition may occur, such as eczema or psoriasis, only doctors won't know this is liver-related either. Usually the baby's liver will eventually recover, strengthen and heal as she or he grows older. The acid reflux will disappear and no one will ever realise a liver problem was afoot. If liver problems resurface later, no one will connect it to that person's struggles in babyhood. This is how the true story of somebody's health gets lost along the way, with the connections we're supposed to be able to make so we can understand our lives instead buried, lost, or undiscovered. There's a reason that it's completely off the radar of medical research and science that babies are born with compromised livers all the time. If the inherited poisons we receive from our forebears were identified, catalogued and documented properly, all the way down to which chemical factories, how far back in history created each toxic chemical, in each toxic solution that's ended up in our everyday environment, from pesticides sprayed on our grandparents' lawns, to nanotechnology materials sprayed on manufactured items, to plastics and even to viruses that are fed on all of this. Every mum on this planet would have a new cause to fight for. Mums would truly make change happen, knowing that her baby had been hindered in part by what had collected in her liver and her parents' livers and her grandparents' livers and her great-grandparents' livers without their consent, knowing that these industrial mistakes were the reality behind her baby's emergency room visits and nights with no sleep. Each mum would demand that the rightful sources be held accountable. There would be hell to pay. Medical research and science want no part of unleashing that. It would be their greatest nightmare, because without the gene theory or the body attacking itself theory to lean on, the medical industry would be held accountable to mums and babies for the first time in history. Signs and symptoms of child liver. Poking that hornet's nest of answers would also reveal that it's not just babies these liver inheritances affect. It's children too. Unexplained constipation, stomach pain, intestinal spasms and gastritis. These are liver-based symptoms that you've read about in previous chapters. When they happen to a young child, they mean she or he started life with a sluggish, stagnant liver from the get-go. If the child's also eating troublemaker foods like gluten or dairy, or taking antibiotics regularly, the digestive situation can worsen. The food itself will get the blame, when the truth is that it's the gluten and dairy and antibiotics worsening the liver condition that's already there or feeding early pathogens inside the liver, preventing it from performing as it should and leading to constipation or other intestinal issues. Other problems that can develop as a result of what I call child liver, a compromised liver in childhood that occurs as the result of inherited poisons and pathogens, include Crohn's disease and colitis. In the case of colitis, it's one of the 31 varieties of the shingles virus, getting its start in the liver and then launching a new, successful life in the colon. Many other pathogens, including strep, reside in children's livers because the liver collects them to try to keep them from spreading to other parts of the child's body. The liver's goal is to destroy the unproductive viruses, bacteria, and more that live within it. However, if there's enough food there in the form of toxins, including heavy metals, such as mercury and aluminum, the pathogens survive and sometimes become unruly. After sitting in wait, the viruses and bacteria can go rogue and escape from the liver, causing IBS, other inflammatory issues in the digestive tract, or problems elsewhere, such as early mono, strep throat, ear infections, acne, bronchitis, random rashes with pustules, mysterious boils, hives, random swollen glands, fever and blisters. Child liver determines more of children's health and well-being than we know. In addition to the above and many of the symptoms and conditions you'll find throughout parts 2 and 3, child liver can generate a lot of liver heat, especially when the organ is filled with toxic heavy metals. That can translate to unexplained irritability, anger, frustration, and even tantrums in young ones that leave many parents and caregivers feeling powerless. When it's struggling, the liver can lack glucose storage at a young age, creating a hungry liver that creates the mystery hunger we heard about in Chapter 13. That liver starving for glucose can also get little ones very cranky, with low blood sugar episodes, fatigue, and seemingly random tiredness due to the adrenal output required when the liver's glucose storage is low and blood sugar drops. Around age 3, 4, or 5, it's common for the liver to come out of stagnation and for symptoms and conditions to go away, at least temporarily. PANDAS. PANDAS is another confusion in medicine today, which is unfortunate, because when it comes down to our children especially, we want things done right. We don't want a mystery aspect. At this point, PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections, is openly theoretical. The associated symptoms include tics, spasms, twitches, and acute attacks of OCD, with the reasoning